Good evening, and welcome to this edition of Health Matters. November is Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month, and tonight we'll be discussing this very disease. Pancreatic cancer doesn't seem to get as much press as other forms of cancer, but it is one of the leading causes of cancer death, about 30,000 per year in the United States. And joining me tonight, well, we have one Health Matter veteran and public radio veteran here, Dr. Sanford Katz, radiation oncologist. And welcome, Sandy,
Thank you.
Being on the air. And also Dr. Anil Veluvalu, who's a hematologist oncologist, also with Willis Knighton. We'll also be taking your calls throughout the program. Our number here, toll free, is 800-552-8502. And Dr. Veluvalu, also welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So I think the first question that I really want to start off with is because I just did kind of a quick little survey of people here and asked, do you know where your pancreas is? And generally the blank faces told me that no one really does. I think it's an organ that not very many people understand. So can you, first of all, tell us where it is and also what it does?
Okay, the pancreas is located in the left upper quadrant, just posterior or behind the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And it secretes certain hormones that assist in digestion. People usually when they are become symptomatic, when they seek assistance for a possible diagnosis of pancreatic cancer, are usually quite advanced in their disease because the pancreas, when it does develop a carcinoma, doesn't yield many symptoms initially when it's in the lower stage.
Okay, well, why don't you talk a little bit about that then? So what are the symptoms of pancreatic cancer, at least the ones that make themselves obvious?
The most common thing that people will think about is pain, maybe jaundice. That's when people turn yellow. They can have nausea, vomiting, weight loss. People may present with clots. There can be very many nonspecific symptoms, diarrhea, discoloration of the urine, to name a few.
Mm-hmm. Are there any risks in particular that are associated with getting cancer?
There is. Smoking has been associated with the development of pancreatic cancer, as well as some inherited or hereditary syndromes, which may account from 5 to 10% of patients who have been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer.
Okay. You're listening to Health Matters tonight, and that is what we're discussing this evening, pancreatic cancer. Your questions are welcome. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That is 800-552-8502. I know cancer tends to be kind of a generic term. Are there different types of cancers that we lump under pancreatic cancer?
There are different types of pancreatic cancer. The most common type that we see is a pathologic diagnosis of adenocarcinoma. But there are other types of pancreatic carcinomas that are characterized as pancreatic endocrine carcinomas.
Mm-hmm.
And these particular cancers secrete certain hormones that may cause other types of symptoms, such as diarrhea, peptic ulcers, and so on.
That is considerably more rare.
Very rare.
The typical pancreatic cancer is the one that's the adenocarcinoma that we more commonly speak
And that
about.
Arises from the glands of the pancreas.
Okay. Now, you were mentioning earlier, and I guess this is one of the reasons why it's such a deadly disease, is that it doesn't tend to get diagnosed early on. Now, why is that?
By and large, by the time you have symptoms, the cancer has progressed to a point where it's rather, extensive. So, by the time you would have symptoms such as pain, normally the pancreas has gotten so big that it's obstructing the flow of bile out of your bile ducts. And, and then that's when you present. In fact, you might not even have any pain at all. You might just start to become jaundiced, and it's an indirect effect of the pressure that the mass in the pancreas is placing on the bile ducts. So you then go to the doctor, and by the time it's discovered, the cancer is not only, an advanced cancer in the pancreas itself, but it may have spread to the lymph nodes in the region, in the abdomen, and even to the liver. And what makes it so challenging is that really the best results in terms of treating pancreatic cancer is to catch it early.
Mm-hmm.
But so few people who develop pancreatic cancer are caught early. So the vast majority of people, by the time they have symptoms, they show up and they're no longer a surgical candidate. And the best treatments that we have at that point may only be limited in terms of benefits. So, a situation like that, you may be limited to chemotherapy alone or maybe even chemotherapy and radiation, neither one of which are likely to be curative, really. The only chance for cure, albeit small, even in those people who are deemed resectable or operable are those people who can get surgery and then chemotherapy and radiation after. And it represents a very small minority of those people who were diagnosed. So it's been a particularly challenging effort to identify people who are at risk of developing pancreatic cancer and screening them. We have screening programs for breast cancer and colorectal cancer, even for head and neck cancer and prostate cancer. But, you know, there really isn't widespread screening of pancreatic cancer. And part of the reason is because it's a much less common cancer. It's really, while it represents the fourth number four cause of cancer death, I mean, it's about 90% or more of people who get pancreatic cancer die, which makes it, you know, a huge killer, much more so than lung cancer or breast cancer, but so many fewer people actually are diagnosed. So to screen the general population is just not cost effective.
Right. So how do you diagnose this cancer?
There are multiple modalities that are used today. With the advent of something called endoscopic ultrasound, they can insert a probe through the oral cavity down the esophagus into the stomach and into the small intestine and use that ultrasound probe to discover pancreatic tumors and also afford a biopsy and even evaluate lymph node status. CT scans are also very effective. Another procedure called ERCP, endoscopic retrograde cholangiopancreatic.
Yeah, you'll have to explain that one.
Right. It's the same procedure, but they insert a catheter into the pancreatic duct, and they're able to explore that duct, and they're able to get what they call brushings in order to make a diagnosis, a pathologic diagnosis, sometimes if the duct is involved with the disease. And diagnosis is based on obtaining a pathologic specimen and reviewing that with the pathologist underneath the microscope to make a definitive diagnosis.
On those occasions where you're able to diagnose the disease early on, how does that usually present itself? Because you were just saying that it, you know, the symptoms come later, but there must be times when...
Oftentimes it's discovered accidentally.
Really?
Someone has a CAT scan for another reason. Let's say they get in a car accident or, you know, they have some abdominal pain and just, just by chance, a CAT scan that's performed for another reason identifies a mass in the pancreas. That's probably the best case scenario. However, there are certain populations of people who are at increased risk of developing pancreatic cancer, and some institutions do offer screening programs. And you know, and in those small groups of patients, they can identify the cancers early on. But that's unfortunately more the exception than the rule.
Okay, November is Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month, and that is the disease that we're discussing on tonight's Health Matters. I'm joined by Dr. Sanford Katz and Dr. Anil Velivalu, and your calls are welcome. Give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. Again, the number 800-552-8502 on the special edition of Health Matters this evening. I'm Kermit Poling, by the way. I didn't say that at the beginning, but I figure most of you know my voice anyway, so there you go. The treatments, then. Once the disease is discovered, how is this treated?
Well, the patient has to be first evaluated to deem if it is possible to resect the disease or not. If the patient is amenable, in regards to their performance status, their strength, their nutrition, and the resectability of the primary tumor, we refer them to a hepatobiliary surgeon for evaluation for resection. The most common procedure that we perform on these patients, or the surgeons perform on these patients, is called a Whipple, and that's an extensive resection of the tumor part of the small intestine and the stomach and the lymph nodes in order to also definitively stage the disease. Pancreatic cancer is staged based on the size of the tumor, the nodal involvement, how many lymph nodes are involved, and the spread of the disease. As Dr. Katz mentioned earlier, pancreas cancer likes to spread to lymph nodes, to the liver. It can go to the peritoneal cavity. That's the lining of the entire abdomen. It can also go to the lung and bone. So it's very important that we stage these patients properly in order to affect an effective treatment plan for them.
So just to follow up with Dr. Villavalu, staging is a process by which doctors determine the extent of the cancer Okay, so the first thing you have to do is you first have to make the diagnosis that the cancer is there.
Okay.
And the next step is to determine how extensive is it. Because if the cancer is localized, it potentially could be removed. And then you have to consider patient-related factors. I mean, you have tumor-related factors, but then you have the person, the individual who has the cancer, and that has to be considered as well. So is this person, you know, otherwise healthy? Do they have a lot of other medical problems that might preclude them from having an aggressive surgery like the Whipple procedure? And you know, is it anywhere else outside the pancreas? Is it in the liver? If it's beyond the confines of the pancreas and the lymph nodes, and it's in the liver or in the bone or the lung, then there's really not much value to doing that surgery because you're only removing part of the cancer.
Right.
So the staging process is basically a procedure by which doctors will order a number of tests and determine the extent of the disease. And based upon that information, will help to determine the best course of treatment.
How long of a period of time does it usually take to go through all of the tests?
It depends where you are.
Okay.
We're very fortunate in Northwest Louisiana and really blessed by a fantastic number of hospital systems with very good technology and very good response time in terms of getting information back to patients. In the Northeast, where I'm originally from, it can take weeks to coordinate scans and biopsies and specialists appointments, and you know, it can take many weeks, and that certainly can be very important in terms of sometimes the difference between being treated definitively, or that is for cure, or palliatively, that is just to alleviate symptoms. But you know, in the Shreveport, Bossier area, and in fact in this whole region of the Arklatex, we're rather effective in getting people evaluated within just a couple of weeks, which is a pretty rapid rate.
We're discussing pancreatic cancer this evening on tonight's Health Matters. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. We'd love to hear your question this evening. Amanda from Alexandria has been patiently waiting for us here. Amanda, go ahead with your question this evening. Welcome aboard.
Thank you. Well, I was wondering, whenever you go in to see the doctor for a regular checkup or anything, and you get your red blood cell count and your white blood cell count, and would everything come back normal if you have pancreatic cancer? Would there be some abnormal levels there?
What you're talking about is a CBC, a complete blood count that checks your white blood cell and the different characteristics of it, as well as the red blood cells and the platelets. And they certainly can come back normal even with the diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. With some of these patients, however, you may see that they have become anemic due to the disease, or maybe even bleeding associated with the disease. But that is not a definitive test to make the diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. And a normal test does not rule out the diagnosis of pancreatic cancer.
Is the one of the treatments, is the pancreas one of those organs that's sometimes just removed in the treatment?
Yes, it's removed, but you know, the pancreas has a number of essential functions.
That's what's
largely, I mean, it produces the enzymes that assist people in digesting their food. So if you have your pancreas removed, you can replace those enzymes with pills, effectively, to replace, you know. And the other is insulin. People who have diabetes, oftentimes their pancreas may not produce insulin. Sometimes it produces insulin just fine and they're insensitive to it. So those are the two main functions. And you can supplement both the pancreatic enzymes for digestion as well as the insulin for diabetes. So it's not essential, although it's certainly a nice organ to have and probably underappreciated.
Okay. We have our next caller. This is Doug from Shreveport. Good evening, Doug. What's your question?
Hey, you hit on one of my questions. I was wondering what the difference in treatment is between diabetes and someone with pancreatic cancer, if you have to remove it, because I know transplant isn't an option there.
Is there ever a case of transplants for pancreas or no?
I don't think that we typically do transplants for pancreatic cancer. Usually, people who have end-stage kidney disease with associated diabetes will go on to sometimes receive a kidney pancreas transplant, but it's not an indication to treat the diagnosis of pancreatic cancer, however.
Once someone is treated, it sounds like this is a cancer that it stands a great likelihood of recurring. Is that true?
That's correct.
So that
surveillance is very key, and monitoring and taking care of these patients even after they've received a definitive surgical resection and chemotherapy and radiation therapy afterwards, we still monitor these patients very closely. There is a tumor marker that we can evaluate in some of these patients called the CA19-9, and if it's elevated at diagnosis and it subsequently returns to normal after surgical resection and chemotherapy, we monitor that for an elevation in subsequent follow-up of patients to possibly diagnose a recurrence. Now, sometimes we'll see an elevation in CA19-9 without any definitive disease. It may lag behind that abnormal blood test, but it's something that we closely monitor.
All right. Tonight's Health Matters, if you have a question, the topic, of course, pancreatic cancer, the number 800-552-8502. We have Mike from Lufkin on the air now. Mike, go ahead with your question.
All right. You may have already answered this, and I missed it, but I had a two-part question. Number one, did you make reference to specific groups of people who were more at risk of contracting that? And part two, is there any hereditary factors if you had a parent that died from pancreatic cancer? Are there any hereditary factors involved with that?
That's an excellent question. You mind?
You go ahead.
Okay. That's an excellent question. You know, in terms of risk factors and hereditary factors, that is, you know, things that you largely can't control, there have been a number of things that have been identified. One is age. You know, over 50, you can't control that, and being a male. Also, your race or your ethnic disposition, such as African Americans, Pacific Islanders, Native New Zealanders, and even Ashkenazi Jews, which are Jewish people who are from Eastern European extraction. There are also a number of hereditary familiar factors, like genetic factors, that probably represents only about 10% of cases of pancreatic cancer. And those cases where it's hereditary, it's much, much higher risk. So some of the some of those in particular include a familial, with something called a familial atypical multiple mole melanoma syndrome. That's one. Another is something called Peutz-Jeghers syndrome. And even a familial breast cancer syndrome. You know, we hear a lot about something called BRCA1 and BRCA2, which are breast cancer genes, which increase your risk of developing breast cancer. But there's also an association between one of them, BRCA2, and pancreatic cancer. And they're finding that in families where there are at least two first-degree relatives who have pancreatic cancer, there are higher rates of this particular gene, this BRCA2. And then, you know, just having a number of first-degree relatives with pancreatic cancer, you know, sister, brother, aunt, that can increase your risk 18-fold higher than just having, you know, a sporadic case. And if you have three affected first-degree relatives, it can be as high as 57-fold increase risk. So there's nothing you can do if you have these risk factors, but it certainly suggests that you should be under some screening, you know, to identify it early.
And that recommendation for screening may include having a CT scan at age 35 or at least 10 years below the age of that relative's age at diagnosis, although there's no screening program in place, as Dr. Katz mentioned earlier.
All right. We have another caller, this one from Shreveport. This is Dara. I think I've got your name right. I hope I do. Dara, go ahead with your question this evening.
Thank you. That's correct. And the last caller really touched on a lot of my questions. My mother passed away secondary to pancreatic cancer, and I was wondering, you know, that, and I heard that made me at increased risk. What sort of things could I and my siblings do to be more aware or to protect ourselves from this?
First question is, how old was your mother when she was diagnosed?
She was 70.
70. Okay, the higher the risk for that familial syndrome is usually when they're diagnosed at a younger age.
Okay.
So I don't know that we could make any specific recommendations for you to have screening CAT scans. This may have been a sporadic case, as it's called, of pancreatic cancer diagnosed in your mother.
All right. So, did you have another question, Dara?
No, I don't. Thank you. That was
all right. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. When earlier on, before we went on Mike, you had mentioned, and I sometimes wonder if this also is an obstacle to getting diagnosed. A lot of people have, for one reason or another, a fear of, you know, if something's wrong, necessarily going and getting checked out. I know cancer in particular, there are all kinds of misconceptions that are associated with it. We were talking a little bit about that. What are some of the misconceptions that people have?
Well, the first obstacle that many people face is a sense of denial. Many people, you will get their history from them at time of diagnosis, and they'll tell you that they've had the symptoms for quite some time, but yet they just disregarded them and would not seek medical attention. So that's the first obstacle we face. But there are many misconceptions that we encounter in our practices. Just to list a few of them, many people come to us and ask us if they eat glucose or sugar, are they feeding their cancer? And this is a common misconception that is untrue. Another misconception is that if their cancer is exposed to air, such as with a biopsy or surgical procedure, that it will cause it to spread. This is also a common misconception. No one is immune to cancer, and cancer is also not always a death sentence. Many cancers that we're able to treat relatively effectively lately can become chronic conditions in some sense. I tell my patients frequently that more people in this country die of heart disease every day, more than what we diagnose and treat in our office, to give them an idea that nobody is curing, in a sense, heart disease or diabetes, which are big killers in this country. The other misconception that I can think of is chemotherapy. Everybody feels that chemotherapy is going to make them horribly ill, and they'll be carrying buckets around with them to vomit in. But I invite them to visit our cancer center. If you just spend some time in our waiting room, you'll see that our patients that are getting chemotherapy, we are able to manage many of their side effects quite effectively.
Is part of the reason that the technology, the knowledge of the treatments and how you administer the chemotherapy or the radiation for that matter, just it's that it's improved so much?
I think that's part of it, Kermit. I think the other issue is that many of the medications that we use to manage the side effects have come a long way in the last 20, 25 years. Before, when we'd have to admit many patients in the hospital to manage side effects, we now give that chemotherapy outpatient. Nausea and vomiting, which was a huge problem with cytotoxic chemotherapy in the past, we can control up to 85% of that with the oral medications that we have available to us these days. So we're able to manage and provide a quality of life. That's the ultimate goal in treating cancer, is providing a quality of life.
In some cases, particularly breast cancer, it's not unusual for women to gain weight after a course of chemotherapy. Now, that might be equally as daunting, but it's not, you know, it's not the nausea and vomiting and the buckets, as Dr. Villavallo has described, that people envision. And I really think it's been decades. You know, the flip side of that also is that if we have better medicines to manage the side effects associated with therapy, then people are able to tolerate more intensive therapy, more aggressive therapy, and the cure rates can often be better. Certainly, it depends on the type of disease that you're fighting. Unfortunately, pancreatic cancer has not seen the progress that some of the other cancers, particularly breast cancer, has been demonstrated. But really, there are a lot of misconceptions.
You're listening to Health Matters this evening. Our topic is pancreatic cancer, and I'm joined by Dr. Sanford Katz, radiation oncologist, and Dr. Anil Veluvalu, who's an oncologist hematologist, and both with Willis-Knighton Health System. And your calls are welcome, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we have our first caller from East Texas this evening. June, go ahead with your question.
Yes, what I was just wondering about, my mother had her gallbladder problems, and from the time she was 22, and they finally removed her gallbladder when she December of 52, and she was just 52 years old. And about three weeks after, she felt real bad, and all of a sudden they tried to find out what was wrong. And they couldn't find out what was wrong. And so then she died. And we had an autopsy done. And they found that her pancreas valve that was coming from the pancreas into the abdomen had reversed itself, and it was all of everything was going back into her pancreas instead of into the abdomen and the stomach. And it was not pancreatic cancer, but it was this, what I'm telling you, and she was only 52. And I was just wondering about the possibility of, should I be checked for anything like that? Or do you think that, and it definitely was not cancer, it was just the valve was going in the wrong direction.
As tragic as that must have been for you and your family, you know, it's fortunate that that those things don't occur very often. But it does kind of address the point that, you know, surgery in the abdomen, particularly when you're talking about pancreatic surgery, and specifically the Whipple procedure, which Dr. Vellavello mentioned earlier, which is the main surgery which is performed to treat pancreatic cancer. This is a very complicated surgery. In fact, it's probably the most complicated, or one of the most complicated surgeries that a surgeon will learn how to do. And in order to do it well, you really need specific expertise and training, and you need to do a lot of them. And so we're very fortunate here in Northwest Louisiana that we have a number of physicians here that work as a team and specialize in the treatment of pancreatic cancers and tumors of the liver and biliary system or bile duct system. And they really, and they also do transplants, and they specialize their practice to surgery of this area. And so what we find and what has been demonstrated in a number of studies is that places and physicians who perform a lot of a procedure tend to do that procedure the best. And so what you're describing does underscore the importance of going to see a specialist, particularly when you have a serious diagnosis like pancreatic cancer, and be evaluated by a specialist who treats a lot of them. We're very fortunate that we at Willis-Knighton, we have a joint tumor board that is called the Hepatobiliary GI Tumor Board, which consists of a trained team of specialists from the LSU Medical School as well as from Willis-Knighton. And it consists of radiologists, interventional radiologists who are familiar with the intricate practices of using radiology in this part of the body, medical oncologists like Dr. Vellavello, who specializes in these types of cancers, radiation oncologists, as well as surgeons and pathologists, and together work to evaluate patients who have these types of cancers and direct appropriate care. So I'm very sorry to hear about your mother, but I'm also glad that that problems like that don't happen more often.
We have another caller from Shreveport. This is Peggy. Thanks for waiting on hold. Go ahead with your question this evening.
Okay, I have two questions.
Okay.
And one is, other risk factors like smoking or diet have anything to do with a pancreatic cancer? Mm-hmm. And the other one is, would you say a little bit more about that test, that CA19-9? What is that exactly?
Sure. To address the first part of your question, definitely there are other risk factors associated with pancreatic cancers. First of all, the adult onset of diabetes without any associated factors like obesity or family history should raise a suspicion of the possible diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. Cigarette smoking definitely has an associated risk of developing a pancreatic cancer. Obesity has been definitely proven to have a link with pancreatic cancer. There's no specific dietary factors that they can conclusively associate with the development of pancreatic cancer. There's a question if coffee or alcohol or aspirin, NSAIDs may affect a positive or negative influence on the diagnosis of pancreas cancer. There are
There is some literature that suggests that people who've had a cholecystectomy or partial gastrectomy, that's removing part of the stomach, may be at increased risk of developing pancreatic cancer. Also, the bacteria associated with peptic ulcer disease, H. pylori, and hepatitis B may be associated with increased risk of developing pancreatic cancer. As to the second part of your question, the CA19-9, that is not a useful test in evaluating or screening somebody that does not have at least radiographic evidence of a pancreatic tumor, because many other disorders may affect an increase in that lab value. So it's not an appropriate screening test used by itself.
All right. Our next caller is from DeRidder, Louisiana. This is Clayton. Clayton, thanks for calling this evening. What's your question?
Yes, sir. I was wondering if there were certain dietary factors that predispose one to pancreatic cancer, specifically if heavy drinking has been linked to it, heavy drinking, including smoking, maybe a diet high in sugary snacks such as cookies, donuts, soda pop. And my second part of my question is obesity linked to pancreatic cancer?
Yeah, this, just to follow up, the previous caller, I don't know if you had your radio up and could hear, but yes, in fact, as Dr. Vellevalu very nicely reviewed, there are a number of factors that I think is important to consider the things that you can modify. Okay, you can't modify your risk factors in terms of who your parents are, or if you have a particular high risk in your family. But you can modify things that you put in your mouth and things that you do. So the number one thing I think is, which is the case in medicine in general, but also no less importance in pancreatic cancer, is smoking. Smoking doubles your risk of developing pancreatic cancer, and roughly a fourth, 25% of pancreatic cancer cases are associated with smoking. And if you have a family history of pancreatic cancer, and you have which is like one or two people in your family, and you smoke, you can increase your risk. Who smoke have pancreatic cancer, and you smoke, you have a 3.7-fold increase. That's 3.5 times the risk of developing pancreatic cancer. So you can do something about that. Also, that pancreatic cancer tends to occur earlier in life if you smoke. So smoking is probably the worst thing you can do in terms of increase your risk of pancreatic cancer. In terms of the donuts and the sugary snacks, obesity is felt to be a risk factor, and certainly adult onset diabetes, not the juvenile diabetes where kids are born and they don't produce insulin, but the typically obese adult who has grown insensitive to insulin, that has been shown to be an increased risk of developing pancreatic cancer. And the reason is because the insulin being secreted by the pancreas, has to rev up, and you have to produce more and more and more. And so really what you're doing is you're asking your pancreas to produce more and more insulin because your body has gotten so resistant to the effects of that insulin. So, eating those things definitely increases your risk of developing pancreatic cancer to the extent that it makes you prone to obesity and diabetes. Drinking, chronic pancreatitis or a chronic inflammation in the pancreas is often associated with drinking. Sometimes it's associated with other causes too, but particularly heavy drinking can cause chronic pancreatitis, which has been shown to be a risk factor for developing pancreatic cancer. So these are all things that you can do to modify your risk. And and this is not only just pancreatic cancer appropriate, but appropriate for most of the things that we treat in medicine.
All right, you're listening to Health Matters this evening, or we're talking about pancreatic cancer. This is Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. This is a special edition of Health Matters. Your questions are welcome. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Are there any new studies or developments in the treatment of pancreatic cancer? Anything that's on the radar?
Absolutely, Kermit. Presented at ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting this summer. There is a new chemotherapeutic regimen that's been approved for advanced pancreas cancer, metastatic, unresectable pancreatic cancer. Historically, with treatment, average survival for stage 4 pancreas cancer was on the order of 6 months, okay? With the advent of this new aggressive chemotherapy regimen, they are quoting survival increases to approximately 11 months. Doesn't sound like a lot, but in this disease, that is very impressive. Now, you must take in mind that this new chemotherapeutic regimen is very, very difficult to take. So the patients that need to consider this have to be in great shape with good nutritional support, mm-hmm. and great performance status or strength baseline.
One of the interesting things that I think is relatively unique to chemotherapy treatment for pancreatic cancer is this drug gemcitabine. There was a study that was done a number of years ago looking not specifically necessarily at survival, but quality of life. And this was one of the first times that a chemotherapy drug has been associated with an improvement in quality of life. So, you know, most people think I'm going to take chemotherapy and, yeah, you'll modestly increase my survival, but I'll be miserable for that time.
Right, right.
But just the opposite. So, you know, with this particular medicine, people have seen an improvement in quality of life in addition to increase in survival.
Now, is this something that is available now?
It's available now.
Been studied?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's been around for a number of years.
It's the standard today.
Okay.
It's just, and I think Dr. Katz pointed out a great issue that when we're treating patients with cancer, and particularly when it's incurable, quality of life should be our number one goal.
Mm-hmm.
Extent of life, length of life, when we have multiple technologies that can artificially prolong life, to me and to all of my colleagues that we work with is not an acceptable option. It should be providing the patient a significant quality of life.
Sometimes pancreatic cancer can be very painful too, and particularly if it can't be removed surgically, which is often the case. Sometimes it invades structures in the abdomen that can cause a fair amount of pain, and so treatment is available not only to help to shrink down that tumor and extend people's life, but oftentimes help to alleviate pain and suffering too.
Right, which of course is a quality of life issue. 1-800-552-8502. Call if you have a question for our doctors this evening on tonight's Health Matters. We do have waiting on hold Dwayne from Shreveport. Dwayne, thank you for calling. What's your question?
Thank you. I had pancreatitis in 95, and I was in the hospital for 2 months while it healed within. Am I more susceptible to get pancreatic cancer because of that?
You said you had pancreatitis. Yeah. And so you were in the hospital just one time, and this was an isolated event. I don't believe that a single occurrence of pancreatitis increases your risk of developing pancreatic cancer. However, it's the chronic pancreatitis that has been shown to increase your risk.
Right. They told me I had my hereditary. They said I had high cholesterol, and it wasn't what I was eating. It's just hereditary, you know, and it was off the charts. And so they said I have to watch that. So I was just asking about that, if I'm more susceptible to get the cancer.
Well,
thank you.
If your triglycerides were elevated to a very, very high level, that is certainly a predisposing factor to cause recurrent pancreatitis if it's above a certain value. And those repeated episodes of pancreatitis would put you at increased risk. But I agree with Dr. Katz that one episode would not significantly increase your risk.
Well, that was going to be my next question. If it's a recurring situation,
it's a different story.
It's a different story. 1-800-552-8502, the number to call. And we have now Jerry from Glenmore. I'm trying to look back behind me here to look at the screen. So I'm sorry if I'm reading your name wrong. But Jerry, go ahead with your question this evening.
I missed the first part of your program, and I wanted to hear the symptoms, and I would wonder if you could go back over those.
Sure. Symptoms could be abdominal pain, weight loss, jaundice, that's when the skin, the eyes turn yellow, dark urine, diarrhea. Those are the main ones, Jerry.
All right. 1-800-552-8502, the number to call with your question about pancreatic cancer this evening. What is the role of the oncologist in setting up a treatment plan? I mean, I think a lot of people hear, you know, we hear the titles and we hear, you know, the specialties and all of that. But I don't think a lot of people necessarily understand what that means and what's going to happen.
So you have a number of oncologists. So Dr. Villavallo is a medical oncologist, which means that he's a cancer doctor who specializes in treatment of cancers using chemotherapy or medicines given either by pill or in the vein. I myself am a radiation oncologist, which means I specialize in the treatment of cancer using radiation. There are also surgical oncologists, that is, surgeons who specialize in the surgical treatment of cancer. So, you know, the ideal scenario is a collaboration between oncologists. So you may be referred to a radiation oncologist who will then refer you on to a medical oncology colleague for consultation, or the medical oncology colleague may be the first point of contact, and then they, you know, he or she will refer you on to a surgeon, a surgical oncologist, or a radiation oncologist, or sometimes all three. And, you know, the best scenario when you have a cancer, particularly one that, you know, is as serious as pancreatic cancer, is that your case is presented or discussed in a multidisciplinary environment, meaning lots of different physicians from different perspectives who specialize in the treatment of the disease, you know, evaluate your case and discuss it in an open forum. Even in those scenarios when that does not occur, usually a good collaboration between a number of doctors who treat cancer from different perspectives can help to ensure that you get optimal care. Because sometimes you need one, that is, maybe you need surgery, sometimes you need chemotherapy, sometimes you need radiation, or sometimes you need two or three. So it's, you know, there are pretty well-established guidelines that we follow. You know, we don't really make it up along the way, but we do try to tailor those guidelines as appropriate to a particular patient. So sometimes if, you know, the ideal situation would be a combination of surgery and radiation and chemotherapy, but the person is just not fit enough to have surgery, they may receive only one of those three or two. So it's really more of a collaborative decision-making process.
Well, it sounds like the advantage there, though, is that you're not just relying on one opinion, but that of a group of specialists.
That's correct. And normally there's one doctor, many times, depending upon the nature of the cancer, who is kind of like your primary oncologist.
Okay. So what do patients need to look for when they're looking for these options? I mean, where do they start?
I think that when they are looking towards treatment for these types of diseases, first of all, as Dr. Katz had mentioned before, is going to a facility that has all of these different modalities available to them. A surgical oncologist that is very experienced in resecting these types of tumors, and it's not uncommon or rude to ask that physician if he's what his experience with that is and how many cases he's done. To seek out oncologists and radiation oncologists that work well together. Our facility, we have all of these modalities afforded to our patients in one building. We also meet every couple of weeks in order to facilitate patient care. As Dr. Katz mentioned, sometimes working up these patients can take several weeks or more. But by meeting in these multidisciplinary tumor boards, we're able to expedite patient management decisions. We can come up with a consensus when we have all of these physicians in one place, and that greatly affects how fast people are treated. And I think that's important because these cancers, as mentioned earlier, do have to be attacked with multidisciplinary input.
And, you know, we're fortunate if you are part of a large enough group or healthcare system where you're able to subspecialize, even in the field of cancer, that usually means that you have better expertise in a particular, you know, a particular diagnosis. Dr. Villavallo, one of his areas of expertise is gastrointestinal tumors, of which pancreatic cancer is one. Mm-hmm. Treat pancreatic cancers, my colleague, Dr. Michael Dersey, in our group, in our radiation oncology group, specializes in these types of cancers. And, you know, and so if you've got a situation where people are, you know, are experts in a particular thing, I think that in general you're going to get more expert care.
All right. Tonight's Health Matters, a special edition. It's Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month, and that's what we're discussing this evening. I have Dr. Sanford Katz and Dr. Anil Veluvalu, and your call is welcome at 800-552-8502. And I have another caller that's waiting on the line, and this is Duane of Shreveport. Duane, go ahead with your question.
Yes, sir. I'd like to know, how do we in Shreveport and the Bossier area, how do we rate with the Cancer Treatment Center of America, like the one in Oklahoma, or Tulsa, Oklahoma, for treatment of cancer here locally? They, you know, we always, and I'd like to know the comment, do we have a facilities as better or as equal to what they've got? I'll hang up.
Yeah, thank you for your question. So, you know, locally, I don't know that we advertise as much at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning as Cancer Treatment Centers of America. With that said, you know, that the Cancer Treatment Centers of America is a very good hospital system. By no means would I say that they are leaders nationally amongst doctors in the field. So, you know, as a cancer specialist myself, depending upon your particular diagnosis, I could direct you to a particular hospital or number of hospitals in the country that specialize in the treatment of that particular cancer. And that's, you know, and we kind of know that being in the field. No one hospital system is nationally known for treating every type of cancer, although, you know, they may, you know, it, the name may promote itself. I don't think that's really an accurate reflection of what goes on. With that said, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, to my knowledge, is a very good, you know, good facility, and they do traditional treatment very much the same as what you would have at any, you know, accredited institution, whether it be in Shreveport or in Houston or in Dallas. Now, one thing that the Cancer Treatment Centers of America does incorporate into their treatment paradigms is, I think, more holistic approach and more nutritional support. And that certainly appeals to some people, and I think it's more of a marketing niche. But I can't honestly think of a situation where I would imagine somebody would get better care by going to Cancer Treatment Centers of America than staying here in Shreveport. Now, there certainly are situations where cancers are rare or unusual, or there's a certain expertise, and we refer patients out of Shreveport, Bossier, and, you know, to referral centers, whether it be in Houston or Dallas or sometimes, you know, Little Rock or what have you. But, you know, as good as Cancer Treatment Centers of America is, that's not really a place that cancer doctors refer patients to. It's more, you know, a place that people see the advertisements on television and refer themselves.
That does bring up one question, though, because a lot of people do turn to alternative medicine when they're looking for answers. But it sounds like the very serious nature of how this disease progresses. I'm assuming that, I mean, at least I know for other medical conditions, there are some other approaches that show some positive effects. But my understanding is, at least for pancreatic cancer, that there's nothing that statistically show any kind of assistance from those approaches.
Kermit, are you talking about dietary augmentation?
Dietary or supplements or?
No, I don't believe so. If, you know, as Dr. Katz had mentioned, if you look to the internet and to advertisements, there are any number of different quote-unquote diets that are advertising that they are able to cure cancer or affect a change in cancer. Now, everything that we do is based on empiric data, which mm-hmm. is going through rigorous study protocols, trials, and has proof to affect a change in the majority of patients treated with a certain type of cancer. Now, many of the things that you're going to see on the internet, you need to take with a grain of salt. And if you do find something that you find interesting, my advice would be to print it out and take it to your physician and discuss it with him or her. That's what I encourage my patients to do, because you know, we shouldn't be closed-minded as to the effects of other treatment options that are less studied.
Well, is there – because you brought up something, going to the internet and finding information, and I'm sure that people who are faced with this and the families that are faced with this, they would love to have information. They would love to have access to support groups. Is there somewhere that they should turn, someplace that is dependable?
Absolutely. The American Cancer Society is an excellent resource, and we have a wonderful organization locally here in Shreveport.
that's very active in assisting our patients with many opportunities and to assist them in dealing with their cancer and educating them. The internet is also a resource, obviously, that everyone is going to use. I just guard my patients on going to reputable sites. The National Cancer Institute is a wonderful site that I usually direct my patients to obtain their information. There are any number of topics that you may find if you Google pancreatic cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But with that, yeah, you need to be very discerning as to what you take to be fact and fiction. And really, really, if there's something that comes up that may be contradictory to what you have learned in your office visits with your physician, you need to take that information and discuss it with your physician and make sure you understand it, because there's a level of trust that needs to be maintained between a patient and a physician in order to have a successful relationship.
This I think, is a very important point. I mean, you go on the internet, and sometimes it's difficult to discern which sites or which sources are authorities and which are not.
That's true. Yeah.
Some of the names of the organizations that are really, little more than an alternative medicine organization or someone trying to sell you something, or even for that matter, maybe some well-meaning groups of folks who believe in a particular philosophy, they take on names that sound awfully official when they may not be. So I think a good rule of thumb is anything associated with like the National Cancer Institute or a university hospital website, or maybe even an organization that you're aware of, like the American Cancer Society or Susan B. Komen Foundation. I mean, ones that are obvious, but mm-hmm. but ones that you've never heard of that just kind of sound, they sound legitimate, I would be a little bit cautious. The other thing I'd like to just say about alternative medicine is that I think there are a number of natural compounds that hold tremendous promise in the treatment of cancer. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you look at the origins of a number of chemotherapy agents in particular, they're natural compounds that have been, rigorously tested and synthesized, and now they may be, synthesized, synthetically, but not necessarily extracted from the barks of trees. But nevertheless, they were natural. Radiation itself is really a naturally occurring substance. I mean, it's been around since the Earth was formed. But, just because it's natural doesn't mean that it's not potentially harmful. And just because it's natural doesn't mean that it's helpful. And I'll give a couple examples. I tell my patients that when they're undergoing radiation for the treatment of cancer, they should absolutely not take large doses of antioxidants, which means vitamin C, vitamin E, beta carotene. And the reason for that is there's very good data that's been shown that when people take these antioxidants during radiation, the radiation is less effective, that they're actually blocking the effect of the radiation inside the cancer cell. So while it may seem great that, you're taking lots of doses of vitamin C, you're actually doing yourself harm. It's important that people tell their physician when they're ingesting or taking any sort of supplement so that, we're aware, if there is a potential interaction. The other thing to keep in mind is that the way that these nutritional supplements, as they're classified, are regulated is they're not. They're not medicines and they're not drugs, and they're nutritional supplements. And so they're not regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. They have no regulation at all. And so they can come in from all sorts of places, China being one particular example. And they just because it says there's something on the label of what it is doesn't mean that that's what's in there. And there have been cases where people have, in fact, been ingesting active compounds like estrogens, or even heavy metals like lead, and so it can be dangerous. So that makes me particularly nervous if I don't know what someone's taking, and truthfully, they don't know what they're taking. So if someone does want to take some nutritional supplements, I'm okay with that, particularly if they're coming from like a source like the supermarket or health food store where it's like an American or North American company, mm-hmm. As opposed to something that's a tree bark coming over from Asia. So I think you have to be careful. But the most important thing is you really need to keep open dialogue with your physicians so that, we know what you're taking.
All right, we have another caller on the line here, and we maybe have time for one more call if you're interested in giving your call to us at 800-552-8502, getting very close to the top of the show. But the caller, I don't have your name, but go ahead with your question.
My name is Shirley Shedd. I'm from Sibley, Louisiana.
Hi, Shirley.
I was calling because I am very concerned. My sister was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer on April 30th, her birthday. And June 1st, she was dead. I have an aunt that on my daddy's side that died of colon cancer, another aunt on my father's side who died of pancreatic cancer. My elder sister has recently been diagnosed and cleared of ovarian cancer. I have some bad habits. I smoke, and I'm scared to death of cancer. And I wonder, are there any tests I can do to see, because I have a morbid fear of cancer, and I'm just scared, and I haven't gotten over my sister's death because we were only 18 months apart.
Yes, the first test that I would perform is you should test yourself to see how long you can go without smoking cigarettes.
I'm a recreational smoker. That's what they call me. Whenever I get nervous or upset, I go and buy the cheapest brand of cigarettes and smoke.
Yes. Well, that's the number one thing that you can do for your health is not to smoke and to have a good diet and to have plenty of exercise. And then, of course, maintaining regular follow-up visits with your physician, do an annual checkup, preventative things like colonoscopies when they're indicated, mammograms. If you're a smoker and you have family history of aerodigestive tract cancers, you may be someone who your physician wants to have a chest x-ray periodically. So there are a number of things that you can do. You can't undone what's already been done, but I think, as long as your physician is aware of some of these concerns, they can talk with you, and also they can screen you appropriately.
But she ate healthy. She weighed only 120 pounds. She did everything right.
Yes, I understand. The genetics are against you. I mean, there's only so much that you can do, and sometimes you do all the right things and bad things happen, and that's just, I guess that's an unfortunate part of the human condition. But, all that you can't really change those things you can't change. So the best thing that I think you can do is to change those things that you can for the better, and to help alleviate some of your concerns, to make sure you get regular checkups with your physician.
Shirley, I agree with Dr. Katz that quitting smoking is the best thing that you can do. But also another point that you may want to talk to your one of your relatives about is if they've spoken to their oncologist about genetic counseling, giving the preponderance of these different types of cancers that have you suffered in your family. So I would ask them, okay?
All right, 1-800-552-8502. Actually, we're not going to be able to take any more calls tonight because we're just about at the top of the show. So we have about 1 minute, a 1 minute summary if someone has concerns, what should they do? Where should they turn?
I think the first person that they should turn to is their primary care physician.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone should have a good relationship with them and maintain their annual checkups. This is a disease that has a 43,000 person annual incidence in this country and almost kills that many people every year due to its aggressive nature and refractoriness to any potential treatment options that we have. Any concerns that they may have, any symptoms that they may have that we discussed earlier in the evening, they should bring up with their primary care physician and allow him to work that up or refer them to a specialist who can handle those issues.
Sandy, anything you want to add?
I don't think I could add anything. I think that was a perfect summary. Thank you.
All right. Dr. Sanford Katz, radiation oncologist here in Shreveport. Also, Dr. Anil Velavalu, hematologist and oncologist here in Shreveport as well, both with the Willis-Knighton Health System. I want to thank you both for being here in a very educational show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Carmen.
I learned a lot. This program is informational in nature only. Remember, if you have any medical concerns, be sure to check with your physician. about any of them. The producer of the show is Renee Moran. Engineer was Bill Beckett with the assistance of Wally Derleth. I'm Kermit Poling, your host and producer of the show. I want to thank you, all of you who called this evening, and I hope that you will be listening for the next Health Matters, the next time that we have one scheduled. This is member-supported Red River Radio, a public radio service of LSUS. You're tuned to KDAQ, Shreveport, Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria, Pineville, KBSA El Dorado, Magnolia, and KLDN Lufkin, Nacogdoches. We do stream online at redriverradio.org, and we also broadcast on translator K214 CE Grambling. It's about a minute now before 7 o'clock, and Fresh Air coming up next this evening, here for you on your public radio station, celebrating 25 years, Red River Radio.